I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
I'm going to give the audience what I think they want.
They want chase scenes and car crashes.
They want the cops to bend the rules to get the job done. They want the boy to get the girl. They want the good guy to win. They want the bad guy to die, hopefully in the biggest explosion the budget will allow. But most importantly, Senator, they want to walk into a theater and for 90 minutes forget the fucking mess that you have left of this nation.
Go get your bubblegum.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Hello and welcome back to All Out of Bubblegum, the podcast. Today we're going to be talking about the 1976 new wave revisionist western directed and starring Clint Eastwood, The Outlaw Josie Wales. Well, I guess I'd say mostly directed by Clint Eastwood.
Yes.
Because, yeah, I think it was Philip Kaufman who was the original director, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so, shit, this one is a well-regarded classic, and I do not disagree. I think this is a great movie.
Yeah, I agree as well.
And I expect Brandon to hate it.
Yeah.
No, I didn't hate it. It's just okay. Go ahead.
Okay. No, this is... It's sort of like a weird echo, a continuation, but a more thorough examination of the character that this kind of like Western archetype that Clint Eastwood had sort of more or less created with Leone in his Man with No Name films. But it's like he just adapted it to someone else's work, but he made him like a way meaner son of a bitch.
That's fair to say.
What's really funny about this movie is that I just... rewatched Gladiator the other day.
Yeah.
And this movie is very echoed in that.
Oh.
Like, down to, like, him burying his family after they've been murdered, and then just kind of going on a, like, ruthless, vengeful journey. But then it, like, swings and goes this whole other libertarian way in the back half of the film.
Yes. I can enjoy films of various political persuasions. Like, I love John Milius movies, even though he worships, like, nuclear bombs and stuff like that. But, like, there was just something that felt a little off to me about this film's politics. And it's not the only gripe I have, but it does feel a little like some neo-Confederate propaganda going on in this film. And if you dig a little deeper, it turns out that the person who wrote the book that the movie is based on, Asa Carter, he was actually the speechwriter for George Wallace, who came up with, like, the segregation now, segregation in the past, segregation forever, whatever it was. I'm not going to look it up. That line, he came up with that line and wrote it for George Wallace. And he had a falling out with Wallace after Wallace went moderate, and he changed his name to Forrest Carter after the founder of the KKK. And he tried to pretend he was a Native American, got a tan, so now he's Native American. He wrote this book, and it...
What? It worked for Charles Bronson.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It became Charles. Yeah. Worked for Charles Bronson, but I don't know. There's just something about the politics in this film that's a little off-putting. I mean, I don't generally hold politics against a film, but there's other things I have against this film, but to me it's just okay because there is this kind of like neo-Confederate propaganda in the background with like the demonization of the carpetbagger character and the demonization of like the Union soldiers who just want to massacre these guerrillas who probably committed a lot of war crimes of their own. It's just a little iffy to me.
Okay.
I think this is a film that is open to a lot of different interpretations. And I think that's what makes it interesting to me.
Okay.
I think you can read it the way you do, but I think it's also possible to read it almost the exact opposite way. I don't know quite yet how I read it, but it's an interesting film.
Yeah, well, on its face, the movie is... really like this, like, it's kind of conciliatory, like, it's sort of, why can't we all just get along? Like, it is, like, I could see somebody, like, taking that read, right?
Yeah, yeah, he gets along but with the former Kansans who come to Texas.
Yeah, but it's, you know, and then, you know, makes a pact, like a blood brother pact with the Native American chieftain that kidnaps the two boys or whatever, and, you know, just stuff like that. And you know, it's like, if I just have my own little piece of the world to live in, I will be harmless, you know, this whole, like, thing. But that's, like, this kind of objectivist, like a weird libertarian thing that is like this undercurrent that runs throughout the movie. And, you know, I think Clint Eastwood is definitely leaning into that. But really, like, you're talking about a guy who is a butcherer, a murderer, but they're like, oh, no, but the North was actually really bad. It was the war of aggression, that kind of thing. Like, that's what they're really saying in the background. Like, nope, the South was a just cause kind of thing. Forget slavery. That was not really it. You know, that's like the undercurrent in there.
Yeah, yeah. It completely ignores that. It's just kind of about...
So...
Go on.
No, that's... I see what you're saying, and I kind of agree with you, but that's... It's like when I watch Cobra, though, this is just like, nah, the character is so badass that I'm like, I don't even care
anymore. Yeah, that's fair. That's fair to say. I mean, there are a lot of films I enjoy with different politics than what I have, but...
Yep.
The Outlaw Josie Wales, it almost seems like a bridge too far in some ways regarding politics. It's like the Gone with the Wind of Western films.
Kind of, yeah. There's a point where it's almost like parody because he's so ridiculously awesome the whole time that it's like, it's funny.
Yeah.
Like, I think when he gets on the Gatling gun in the beginning of the movie, like that's like the level of like, what the fuck are we talking about? And every time he talks, he's like spitting tobacco on the dog, you know, just this like, what are we doing here? Like, it's so ridiculous.
Yeah.
But I love that, though.
Well, and that kind of goes into like my other criticism of the film that's not politics related, is that it does feel like it wants to be this badass Rambo movie where he's like gunning down thousands of people with a Gatling gun, while at the same time being this slow, quiet, contemplative Western about finding your place in the world and found family and stuff like that. And it doesn't always gel for me. Not always. I mean, half the movie is him just like gunning down millions of people. And then the other half is this kind of like this gentle, almost Western, you know, about him like finding found family. Very kind. Then he kills a bunch of people some more. And I don't know. It just felt a little off at times.
I will agree that the movie seems to forget the whole revenge and pursuit part of its plot for quite some time. But I think the start and the ending are just so good that it's fine.
Okay.
Well, I think that they had an opportunity to be one of those like, hey, I can be the one that ends the cycle of violence. And that's sort of what the ending is.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't really like take that as much to heart as it does, you know, everything would be fine if you just leave me alone. Like that libertarian kind of mindset, that don't tread on me thing, which is really what it's saying, you know, because like I said, on its face you're like, oh, it's sort of like, if we all have our little spot we can be fine. But no, it's he's really just like itching to kill people. Like, that's really what's going on, and that's why there's so much glee in just tons and tons and tons of violence in this movie. Like, this movie revels in it.
Yeah, but I will say, as far as the whole, this movie's trying to say, why can't we all get along? It does sort of provide an answer in, because we're broken inside, because we need love and family. So in that sense, I think it might be saying the opposite. Because presenting this archetypal character and then just saying, oh yeah, but he just needs love, that's sort of like a progressive thing almost.
Yeah, well, again, I think that's the easy viewing of it. I think what it's really saying is we could be fine if the government didn't get involved with us.
Yeah, it is definitely anti-authoritarian, yes.
Yeah.
And I actually found a great quote by Philip Kaufman. It says, fascist is an overworked word, but the first time I looked at that book, that's what I thought. This was written by a crude fascist.
Oh,
was nutty. The man's hatred of government was insane.
Wow.
So, yeah.
It's a little further than I would go.
Well, I haven't read the book, but...
Yeah.
He probably did tone some of it down, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's probably why Eastwood fired him.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think... I guess we'll, you know, let's... I guess we're telling tales out of school a little bit here, but I think that the real reason, once again, that he fired him is because he wanted to bang Sandra Locke.
Yes, probably.
Who, I can't remember, I don't know if my timing is correct here, is still pretending that she is like 20 years old or whatever at this point. And she's certainly playing a character that's supposed to be, I think, a teenager.
Yeah. And she looks maybe not like a teenager, but she definitely looks like 10 years younger.
Yeah, and I think she's like 30, 32 or something in this movie. So
yeah, so 40-something-year-old Clint went, oh, that's perfect for me.
Well, that's just par for the course for an action movie.
Yeah, this is also true. Mm-hmm. I try not to like get too tied up in the politics of a movie. As I know you're saying, you can watch a movie that you don't agree with politically, and I definitely can. That's, you know, it's part and parcel of being an action fan. You know, you're either really into like the super right-wing aspect of movies, or you are ignorant of it. But I just kind of like, I play blissful ignorance, because that's the best way to handle most of these movies.
That's fair, because a lot of them are radical in their beliefs, but this one was just a little too far for me, like with the whole neo-Confederate propaganda and the fact that the author was a member of the KKK and stuff like that. It does feel a little too far. It doesn't have that kind of almost like innocence that something like Death Wish 3 would have, you know, like innocence of just, oh, we gotta kill them because they're bad guys, right? They're ripping off old grandmas and stealing their purses. That makes them bad. We gotta shoot them in the back. It doesn't really have that kind of innocence that one of those campy movies would have. It's a little sinister at times.
It's a little cynical, too. Oh, yeah. It's just like, you know, once again, if the government would just leave us alone, that kind of thing, which is really funny. If you watch a lot of the old Westerns, they're very often like, there's a local capitalist, a land baron, and he's pushing out the townsfolk, or he's murdering, having the town, you know, certain people murdered so that he can take over such and such ranch or whatever, and then the government sends in a spy, essentially, to uncover the plot and then defuse the situation. So it was always like, the government's benevolent, and all these revisionist Westerns, this one being one of the key aggressors in this, are like, no, the government is the problem. These rugged individuals will come in and they'll save us, or at least save themselves and their makeshift families.
Yeah, I do like the found family aspect of it all. Those movies do tend to like resonate with me, like, you know, like where he finds like Chief Dan George's character, that I like. Yeah. That, yeah. Yeah, I like the found family aspect. The action's pretty good, but I do feel like the film's a little confused at times.
I think the action is excellent in this, with the exception of actually that aforementioned Gatling gun scene, which is, you know, they don't bother to pop a bunch of squibs and stuff, which would have made it grade A. But the thing that really sells all the action here, I mean, it's not just that it's really tough and punchy, but it's these ridiculously cool one-liners that he uses to, like, springboard everything off of.
Oh, yeah.
He's always got to say some fucking cool shit. You know, well, my favorite being the bounty hunter character that he's talking to.
Yes.
You a bounty hunter?
Yeah, he's got to do something for a living these days.
Diane ain't much of a living, boy.
That's such a fucking cool scene. You know, and he's totally Mary Sue, whatever, but, you know, that's what you want to see in this. You're at this point where you're just like, yeah, I want to see this guy kick ass, and he does every time.
Yeah, I want to see Clint Eastwood dual-wield pistols on horseback.
It does feel a little ahead of its time in some ways with, like, the whole one-man army aspect of it.
Yeah, this is one of those, like, oh, that this he's Ramboing out, like, half the fucking movie, and it's awesome.
Yeah, you can tell they're kind of exploring what you can do with action. Like, can you have one guy just, like, mow down, like, a dozen guys with a Gatling gun? Or actually, it's probably more than a dozen. But anyway, can you have a character dual-wielding revolvers and just gunning down, like, three or four guys? Can you do that? And the answer is yes.
What's really funny is just that concept of people going and chasing him down, right? Any one of those guys being like, how many of these people this guy killed? And then you're sending like two of us? Like, it's just like ridiculous. But I don't know the inflation. Like, there's a part where they're saying that he's got $5,000 on his head. And I'm just like, I don't know. Like, what is that, a lot of money? Because, like, people really think it's worth it to go after him.
I have no idea.
It sounds like a lot of money back then.
Yeah, well, it must be. because they're like, yeah, well, why not? Like, you think you'd be like, oh yeah, he walked right up. He was like 5 feet from us, and he literally killed everybody. And yeah, we didn't stand a chance.
I also like that they play with the fact that people don't know what he looks like.
Yeah, well, that's how it should be.
Yeah, you don't see that enough in these like pre-modern technology action movies.
Yeah, they got the John Vernon character at the end. He's, you know, is you come back as Fletcher, and he's the only one who really knows who he is, which is again, that's a scene that I like at the end, where he just kind of pretends not to know him.
Yeah,
because that's how it would be. You would have somebody with you. A bounty hunter would bring somebody around that's like, no, I know who he is. I know what he looks like.
Yeah, and that's a great scene at the end. Mm-hmm. John Vernon, where I think the movie is trying to say that it's all down to individual choice if you want to be good or bad, basically.
Yeah, I got the impression that it wants to say something about the willingness of somebody to be the one that ends the cycle of violence. But it's like,
yeah.
I don't know how seriously the movie itself takes that message, because it really revels in its violence.
That's fair to say.
That whole opening is just about the righteous rage of the, you know, that lost cause thing, where they're like, nope, we're just going to ride around and kill Union soldiers. And it just wants to be a little violent movie. That could have been a movie, by the way, that could have been the movie itself, which, you know, again, that's, to go back, that's kind of what Gladiator is in a way, but it's fine. And again, what's not fine, I brought this up before we started recording, but there is a sequel directed and starring Michael Parks where he more or less gets called back into action. It's sort of like Rambo 5. But just not as violent. It's just like people I know are getting hurt, so I'm going to come back into the game, and it sucks.
Sounds terrible.
Yeah, it was only made like 10 years later, but nobody remembers this movie.
I never heard of it until you brought it up right before we started recording.
Well, it turns out that Asa Carter is not a great writer.
Not a great human being, not a great writer.
He's a good bullshitter, apparently, because everyone fucking loved The Education of Little Tree. But, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, and yeah. Circling back to The Outlaw Josie Wales, I do feel like the best parts are the opening and closing, because the middle act does feel a little repetitive to me. Maybe, like, as he goes through, like, the different parts of the Wild West, recruiting his found family. Okay, there's a scene. He finds somebody. He kills a few people. There's family now. Goes up somewhere else, sees somebody in danger, kills some more people. There's found family now. And it does feel, like, a little repetitive, but it's not terrible. I'm not saying this is a bad movie. It's just okay to me. But I do think the middle act maybe could have been tightened up a little, maybe.
Yeah, you do forget to mention that he does all of this reluctantly, which is probably the greatest emotion for Clint Eastwood to have in a movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you can't imagine him being just like a happy guy that
no.
collects friends along the way.
Come down and sit on my lawn.
I mean, that's why Gran Torino, which is like, it's almost parody levels, again, of like what he's known for, which is being that mean old bastard. And
yeah,
and that movie like plays that to the hilt. But then again, he does layer it, I guess, because that's literally the whole thing, is that he befriends this one ethnic kid.
Yeah, I like
that. So it's just like, yeah. But that's what it is. It's like, nope, actually, my angry old man is a bit. It's like his defense mechanism for the world.
That's a very good way of putting it.
You know, yeah. So it's like, I don't know, it's like a reverse of this, which is like not, like he actually is an angry dude who warms to people when there's like the possibility of a new family. Even though you don't really see him as a warm person. He's just a mean bastard in this. You know, again, he's spitting on animals and things. Okay.
I think he genuinely spits on camera like 20 times in the movie.
Yeah, it's plenty. It's more than enough.
Yeah, it's gross.
Have either of you seen High Plains Drifter?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing.
That's a great movie.
Yeah. So that, I think, was his third film. This is his sixth film that he directed. And that one, is it's like, you know, it plays fast and loose with whether or not he's a real person or a ghost. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is his attempt, in a way, to be more straightforward. But I think it's smokescreen because it really has this undercurrent, this libertarian undercurrent. And that's what he's really saying. And in that movie, I'm not really sure what he's saying. It's just like this karmic, vengeful movie. Whereas this is like, no, that what's really true is that the government sucks. And yeah, so I don't know. It's just like this thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, High Plains Drifter is much more apolitical and probably why it holds up a little better, in my opinion, even though it still has a lot of moral ambiguity to it. I mean, like, Clint Eastwood's character is like a freaking rapist in that movie, and it's still somehow... Rapist. He is a rapist.
A possible rapist ghost.
Yeah, he's a rapist ghost, and you still somehow enjoy the movie. Yeah. And that's just the way it goes, because it doesn't, like, inject as much politics into it.
Or at least it's not as on the face, maybe.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. Mm. That said, it's like... I kind of appreciate that he is even willing to dip back into the Western in this, where, you know, because he's at this point, he's Dirty Harry, right? So, and, you know, and you look at it like I think he only directed like one Dirty Harry movie, right?
Yeah, I think it was Sudden Impact.
Yeah. I mean, he made, you know, The Rookie and The Gauntlet, which I think he did right after this, which are basically Dirty Harry movies in all but name. But it's funny that, like, I always thought that like Dirty Harry is his attempt to escape the Western genre, but it's just neat to see that he's like, no, I'm not, like, I don't hate it. In fact, I'll keep going back to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like seeing him kind of, like, craft himself into this persona in a way. Like, he's always, like, playing with the idea of a Western hero. And he really, really understands the iconography, and this movie is probably the most iconic.
Yeah,
you know, outside of the ones he, you know, when he didn't direct.
Well, I even think if you just hear the words Clint Eastwood's cowboy, this is what you think of this character.
Pretty much, like just him, that one scene we're talking about where he says dying ain't much of a living, like that's so ridiculously iconic, you know, and him just. You know, he understands it. He's got there. He sits there with the brim of his hat covering his eyes until just the right moment, like that kind of shit. Like he knows exactly what he's doing, which is why, like, yeah, okay, fine, fucking criticize him, say he's like one note as an actor. I don't agree, but I see where people are coming from. But you can't say dick about his directing. This guy's a fucking miracle worker as a director.
Yeah.
He absolutely understands what he's doing.
Oh, yeah. And he always finishes early and under budget.
Even more impressive again here, because he's literally taking over for somebody else.
Yeah. Finishes 8 days early. Like, Jesus Christ.
Which is another thing people always talk about. Like, he's very mellow as a director. They always say, like, you know, a lot of people go, action, all this stuff. And he just kind of goes, okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, he's just like very, and he doesn't take a lot of takes. He's like, all right, we got it. Or, you know, I think that famously what he says, all right, that's enough of that.
Yeah.
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 I did hear, I can't remember who told the story, but it was basically he said that he started doing that because he worked on Rawhide. And he's like, when the directors would scream action and we're like on horses, and these horses would just be all jarred and nervous. Sometimes they'd kick us off the second they yelled it. So he's like, no, I don't like yelling. I just, all right, and we're rolling. You know, like, real quiet.
Yeah, got to save my voice for those terrifying whispers.
Yeah.
And Eastwood,
like
Eastwood does seem like a pretty gentle guy in real life, based on what I've seen from him. He doesn't seem to be, like, the big, tough guy who's going to, like, beat your face in, like, Steven Seagal or something like that. He does seem like a pretty nice person in real life, as far as celebrities go.
Yeah, I don't think we should get an opinion from Sandra Locke on that one.
Oh my God, please. No.
See if she agrees, but...
well, I mean, in like, yeah.
towards okay. other men and fans, he seems pretty chill. Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was getting at. Sorry, Sandra Locke. I didn't mean that. But like in interviews, I should say he seems pretty nice and chill.
Yeah. And I think actually, like I look at his movies and I haven't seen all of them, but I think like in spite of his political views, I think he's mostly just a humanist as a director, as a storyteller, which is surprising, but you know, that's the side of Clint that I always see, sort of.
I think that he is multifaceted like most people. He's got a lot of things going on. And this, to me, shows that he has that, you know, I guess now it's nobody's surprised anymore, especially, you know, the things he said during Obama's administration. But he is a fairly right-wing person in life.
Yeah, but, like, and he was also, like, 85 when he said those things. Like,
yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
When he said those things to an empty chair.
Yeah.
I guess, again, maybe I'm being cynical when I say that that it's like smokescreen. You're like, oh, if people just leave us alone. But maybe he really does at some level mean it. And I'm just being the asshole here. I'm being cynical. But it's fine because, again, holy shit. You know, you can pretend that right-leaning media is just terrible because it's right-leaning or because it's written by right-leaning guys, that sort of thing. But this is directed by and starring a right-leaning guy who it has right-leaning messages, but it's a fucking great movie.
Yeah. Brandon's surprisingly quiet.
Well, I mean, he's made great movies before, like Unforgiven and High Plains Drifter, but this is not one of the films I would hold up on a pedestal for Clint Eastwood. But I mean, teach their own. It's okay to me. It's an average Western for me for the most part. It evens out.
What's your favorite Clint Eastwood movie?
Favorite Clint Eastwood movie? It's a total cliche, but I got to go with The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I know it's a cliche to say that, but even that has some kind of politics that are kind of murky, that are kind of, you know, like it kind of draws like moral equivalence between the Union and the Confederacy during the American Civil War, which is something I'm not really a fan of, but I can still enjoy it a lot. It's probably my favorite Clint Eastwood movie.
What's a movie that plays the war as almost World War One, right?
Yeah.
It's very like All Quiet on the Western Front when it delves into those themes, particularly blowing up the bridge scene and stuff.
Yeah.
The character that sends him on that mission is, you know, he's right out of that story. But I don't know. I would say that he is anti-war. Because this movie it does feel anti-war. It's like, yeah, that's there. That's an aspect. But it's a brutal, nasty part of humanity. And I definitely believe, you know, when you say humanist, that's immediately what I thought. I remember him not long ago, maybe 15 years ago. He was talking about how war is just this, like, it's just like, oh, it's really sad that how much scientific progress there is during war, because they're like, is that what it takes for us to be that creative, is war? Like, I can't remember the exact quote, but that's basically what he was saying.
I think the quote is on Wikipedia.
Oh.
It says, as for Josie Wales, I saw the parallels to the modern day at that time. Everybody gets tired of it, but it never ends. A war is a horrible thing, but it's also a unifier of countries. Man becomes his most creative during war. Look at the amount of weaponry that was made in 4 short years of World War II. The amount of ships and guns and tanks and inventions and planes and P-38s and P-51s and just the urgency and the camaraderie and the unifying. But that's kind of a sad statement on mankind, if that's what it takes.
Yeah.
And I think that if you watch what I think a very underrated movie, Flags of Our Fathers, it's clearly anti-war.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, I mean, is there such thing as a pro-war film outside of 300? I don't know. I mean, most films are anti-war to some degree, outside of 300. That's obviously very fascistic and pro-destruction, and war is about killing and nothing else, and it should be about killing, but I think most films kind of understand that war isn't great. Even like,
let me tell you about a movie called Green Berets, starring John Wayne.
Okay. Well, even that film seems to understand the horrors of war. I mean, it shows like civilians being massacred. It's not like I want there to be a war in Southeast Asia. I mean, I'm not trying to defend John Wayne's politics, but I mean, it seems to recognize that war is horrible and it should be waged in what he would consider like self-defense. I mean, obviously people can take issue with whether the Vietnam War was self-defense on the United States' part or not, but that's kind of what he seems to be saying there.
There's a whole scene in the beginning of the movie where it's just about how them telling you why the war is so just, why it's so important.
Yeah.
Americans are even over there. It's fantastic. That movie is amazing.
Well, again, I mean, the same thing could be said about World War II movies. Like Casablanca, is that an anti-war movie or a pro-war movie?
Kind of.
Are these, do these terms mean anything?
You know, that's a movie that ends on, I mean, it's really like a, what do you call it? Like a spy movie in a way.
Yeah.
But it's like, we have to come together and defeat evil. Like the last line of the movie is the beautiful friendship line, right?
Yeah.
In that aspect, I guess it's at least pro-intervention.
Yeah.
You know, that's what Die Hard is as well. It's like, if you can do something, do something. Spider-Man in his original incarnation, that's it's a call to duty.
Yeah. But what's the difference between that and pro-war?
It's foggy, right?
Yeah.
It's the fog of war. Whereas
I think this movie, I don't feel that it's pro-war, this movie.
Yeah.
Even though it's like,
oh no,
it sort of luxuriates in its own violence.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely, and it does it really well. I fucking love how the violence is done in this. It's really fantastic. But I wouldn't say it's pro-war. This movie is definitely anti-war, definitely anti-mass killing in terms of like, hey, maybe countries shouldn't be condoning this, but as a matter of like protecting your own, it's like all for it, like full-throated endorsement of violence against trespassers.
Yes.
So it's like, that's like a line that it draws where like government can't condone violence, but I can personally condone it. So yeah, I don't know. It's a hard, I think that's a hard line to walk because this movie doesn't really go into the war aspect necessarily. It's just like, nope, war makes people bastards. Or at least allows the bastards that exist to have power they shouldn't have. Yeah. Is that the whole thing with the people that betray the soldiers at the beginning of the movie?
Mm-hmm.
Or at least in the first act.
Yeah.
Because the beginning of the movie is even more like, nope, they're just assholes and he's going to go help kill now.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure we could have a big philosophical conversation on this, but I don't know if that's appropriate right now. Like, is Come and See an anti-war film? I don't know. I don't know. That's kind of questionable. You don't think it is? Because, I mean, it doesn't say the Soviets should just roll over and let the Nazis kill them all. It says there should be some degree of self-defense, right? Is that pro-war? Is that anti-war? What do these terms mean? I don't know.
I don't think that movie is coming down on the side of, hey, we need to defend against this. I think it's fully about the monsters that war creates. Come and See It is a pretty gross movie. I thought it was pretty obviously anti-war.
I thought it was pretty obviously anti-staying awake.
Well, the way I look at it is like, unless you're Gandhi and you say like the Jews during World War II should have all committed suicide, I don't think you can really say you're anti-war exactly. Because that's what Gandhi said. He said the Jews should just kill themselves like in the face of Hitler. That's pretty anti-war. I mean, that's just about as anti-war as it gets. I don't know. This is going way off track.
Yeah, I just started to think of, like, the story in the Bible, the Romans cornering them on the mountain.
Yeah.
That's what that is. Yeah. I was like, so I think Gandhi's just taking that story, like, and going, well, the logical next step is, and you're like, that's fucked up, Gandhi. Not the most fucked up thing he ever said, either.
Yeah. This is all going to be cut in, like, editing, so we can talk about whatever we want to talk about now.
And you want to know why, though? Because dying ain't much of a living.
Oh, it's tying it back together. Back to the Outlaw Josie Wales. Okay.
Yeah, this is the danger of an ADD podcast. But I see, again, this is, he's got such an eye for iconography. The dual pistols thing, I mean, come on. That's just, it's ridiculous.
And you're like, cool as hell.
And I mean, it's just, holy shit. But he is like on that level, like that's why when you watch Steven Seagal's directorial debut and he makes his character just like so cool that it's a fucking joke.
Yeah.
Like that, this is like, he saw this and was like, I can do that. you know, harder than it looks, isn't it, Stephen?
Yeah. Clint Eastwood did learn the right things from Leone. Because even though I'm not a huge fan of this movie,
100%.
I love the way he, like, frames himself when he, like, walks into, like, a room or whatever. He's got, like, he looks like a cat, you know? He's just got, like, the skinny, killer, vicious predator, you know, he's framed in the screen just perfectly. It looks very cool.
Yeah, he definitely, like, he understands what he looks like, which is really cool, because, like, he's not, like, a, I don't know, like, you know, he's a good-looking guy. At least he definitely was when he was younger. But he understands, like, he has this, like, kind of gaunt appearance. Like, he looks like death, honestly. He looks like death incarnate.
Ooh.
And when he, like, you know, he always, like, pulls his lips back and a little snarl when he talks, you know, so it's just like this skull.
Yeah.
So, you know, he understands that, like, oh, this is my appearance, and he really plays to that. Gives himself a little 5 o'clock shadow, his little cigarette.
Massive scar on his face.
Yeah, it's just righteous fury, which is what we're supposed to have, you know, because of his family and everything. But he's never, like, morose about it. So I don't know. It's like this kind of, like, angry, deadly masculinity.
And all he needs is a hug.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's how he resolves it all. He gets his found family. And that part's pretty nice. Yep.
He's not allowed to cry. No. Yeah, I don't know. It's got to be a tough line to walk. I think that what he's able to pull off every time is always pretty impressive. He understands just the power of images. I think High Plains Drifter really plays to that, but this one is, like, a little more straightforward. And it's a bummer that the book is written by who it's written by, but it's sort of its own animal, but mostly because I have not read the book, so.
Oh.
Maybe it's like, nope, that's exactly what the book's like, and you're horrible for liking it. I don't know.
No.
Also, we should maybe say that nobody involved in the movie knew that Forrest Carter was Asa Carter when they made the movie.
No.
Yeah.
But apparently Kaufman recognized its fascistic qualities and was like, hell yeah, I want to make that. I don't know. That when I heard that, when you said that that's what he said, I'm like, I don't know. That reads as, like, postscript, like a retcon. Like, no, I always knew it was this. But I don't know. It's hard to say. Because I'm like, if you don't agree with it, then why are you involving yourself? This is, like, multi-million-dollar project.
Well, he was trying to write it out, he says.
Yeah. It's just like, why bother then, you know? Like, go something. There's other stories. Ugh, this disgusting fascist story. I'm going to devote 2 years of my life to it. You know, like that's just weird to me.
Did we mention already that Eastwood firing Kaufman caused a rule to be created by the Directors Guild of America?
No, did not mention that.
Called the Eastwood Rule. It's a rule legislated by the Directors Guild of America that prohibits an actor or producer from firing the director and then becoming the director himself. So Eastwood made the history books with this movie, basically.
Good for him.
Had he done that before?
Sorry?
Like, that's... Had he done that before? Because it's called the Eastwood Rule now?
Well, it's because he did it on this one. It was named after him for his actions on firing Kaufman.
It just feels really targeted.
Well, it was because of his actions on this movie. That's why they created the rule.
I love the idea. So I didn't hear about that. I'd heard that there was a lot of, like, dick wagging over Sandra Locke, which is really funny to me because I'm like, is she really that much of a catch? You guys are crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, it feels weird to say something like that, but yeah, I do sort of agree.
Well, but I don't even mean, like, just, like, looking at her or something, like, whatever, everyone, you know, that's subjective.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, like, you're talking about somebody that's, like, a nominal talent, really, and is, like, somebody that famously just, like, lies about their age and lies, you know, all this stuff. I don't know, maybe in person she's just so seductive that everyone's like, yeah, let's get her, I want her. I have no idea, though. I don't get that from anything I've seen her in. Even though I think, like, in Sudden Impact, I think she's actually, like, her natural weirdness or at least what I perceive as natural, makes that movie really work. Because mm-hmm. she always comes off like standoffish, but also like ghostly weird. Like she's got this wide-eyed look that I don't take as like, I think in this movie in particular is supposed to be a young and naive look, whatever. Like, oh my God, the world's so scary out there. but I always take as like, there's like a fury in there. And it really works in Sudden Impact because, you know, that's ultimately what the character is about. Whereas in this, I'm like, she just kind of seems weird. I'm like, how old is this chick? What's she doing? What's her problem? Is she like, oh, I guess it's a love story now? Because that's weird. But yeah. I don't know.
But Eastwood was never picky, I think. He had like 6 families or something at one point.
Yeah, I saw a behind the scenes video when I think it was for Blood Work. And he just started like kissing the head of somebody while they were like talking in the interview. I was like, oh, I don't like that. So I don't know. It was a different time. It was a different time. We'll just say that.
When men were old men.
Men were old men.
Sandra Locke was also married at that time. She was married from 1967 until her death in 2018 to a gay man for tax purposes.
Oh, okay. So sham marriage. Okay.
Yeah, which is just kind of weird.
This Clint Eastwood guy, he's not as normal as I thought he was. No.
Nah, it's fine. You know, I very much agree with the adage, it's the art, not the artist. Because if I get into the weeds about anybody, I just was with Sandra Locke, I guess, I'm just going to end up not liking anything they're doing. You just, at a certain point, especially with actors, but also with writers and directors, you just got to like, you got to look at their output and not what they put out, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what did you guys think of Chief Dan George in this one?
He's great, actually.
He's fucking fantastic.
Yeah, so he was in something else, right?
Little Big Man.
Like, yeah, okay. Like, has he won awards? Because he's fantastic.
I think he was nominated for an Oscar for Little Big Man.
I like Little Big Man because it's just like one of those movies where I think they throw a bunch of old person makeup on Dustin Hoffman for the bookends.
Oh.
And I don't know. For some reason, I kind of... It's like when we watch Terminator 2, we talk about the old Sarah Connor. And I'm just like, there's just this part of me that's always like kind of charmed that they even tried. But Little Big Man is it's another one that's really good. But this guy, he should always be in these movies. any movie where there's an Indian, just get this guy.
Yeah, he should be the next West Studi.
Yeah.
He should have been West Studi.
Yes. West Studi, I love West Studi. He's like, you know, you're watching Dances with Wolves or Last of the Mohicans, you're like, that guy, fuck yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He's fucking scary as shit.
Oh, yeah.
And he's hilarious in Street Fighter, so.
Yeah, because Chief Dan George is hilarious in this one as well. Actually, this movie is just funnier, way funnier than I had originally expected.
I guess, yeah, that's another thing we have not talked about at all, is that there is a really kind of fun sense of humor to this. And a lot of it, pretty much all of it, not all of it, but most of it comes from, like, the genuine humor comes from Dan George. Not like the, he spit on a dog kind of humor. But,
Like, the first time it happened, I was like, did they meant that to be funny? Did he mean that? And then it starts happening again and again. And you're like, oh, they're actually deliberately putting humor in this thing. That's interesting. Especially at the end with him with the old lady. Like, first she says something like, oh, those red-skinned bastards or something. And then later they make a callback where he says, let's kill these pill-faced bastards.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like their relationship. Well,
And that, you know, it's like this, it's sort of called back in Gran Torino, where it's like this verbally, like, racially charged language is used in a way to kind of like humanize the characters. You know, it's like their racism isn't really racism. It's like this like tongue-in-cheek racism.
Yeah, when he calls his barber a Polek.
Yeah.
That's the, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're doing, it's like the same thing. But yeah, I don't know. There's something. I guess that's really where it comes through when you're talking about him being a humanist. Like these characters, they're like multifaceted. And this, yeah. and Chief George is, he's like the heart of it.
Yeah.
He becomes, in a way, the heart of the movie. I think he just brings a warmth that no other character does.
Yeah, it was just so lovable. Just like an old man you just want to adopt as a grandfather or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I wish that guy called me a pale face, you know.
It is also funny that Chief Dan George was like 76 or something when they made this. And in the making of, that granite came out in 99, so 23 years after, Clint Eastwood constantly refers to him as a man in his 80s.
Yeah, well, to Clint Eastwood, he's like, that guy's old.
Yeah.
I'm only 40.
I'm only quarter way done with my life.
Yeah.
Oh God, I hope he doesn't die between recording and this coming out.
No.
Oh, the making of, by the way, narrated by John Milius.
Oh, I need to check this out now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where is this at?
YouTube.
Did you see this?
Oh. Ooh.
Of course.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I've sort of run out of things to say other than I think this is a fantastic revisionist Western. I'd say it's like top 10 in the genre.
Ooh.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite Westerns in general.
Do you think this is his best Western, Eastwood's?
I mean, don't know.
He's probably in the top 10 quite a lot, but...
Yeah, so I really... Like, it's so hard, like... For me, like, if I really had to, like, if you put my feet to the fire, it's this and The Unforgiven, right?
Yeah.
Those are, they're going to be in there. And then you've got at least, you're going to have to pick one of the Man with No Name trilogy to, like, go in there. And now your top 10 has got 3 Clint Eastwood Westerns in it already.
You just need to put in 7 Peckinpahs to round it out.
Yeah. Like, it's tough. I did a top 12 years ago, and I think a lot of Josie Wales included in there.
Mm.
So, I don't know. It's just like, that's tough. Yeah, so for me, it's between Outlaw Josie Wales and Unforgiven. Oh, man, that's hard. It's so hard that I refuse. I'm abstaining.
Smart move.
Yeah. I don't know. God, now I'm, like, really thinking about that. You know, it's I love his Westerns. I think Pale Rider's great. High Plains Drifter. Man. Yeah, I don't know. I'd say this. It's definitely up there. But in my own top 10, it's going to be in there.
Oh.
I'll let Josie Wales going to be in there, yeah.
Well, a while back, we talked about The Chato's Land. Another movie that I surprisingly liked a lot. And it also was more of an actual good movie than I expected. Like both of them, I sort of expected them to just be straight up action movies. Hero kills everybody at the end. But they ended up just being a lot more than that. I do think between these two, I prefer Chato's Land.
Really?
Yeah.
It's definitely the weirder of the two.
Yeah, but it's also 30 minutes shorter.
Yeah, that helps.
Yeah. But yeah, if I had to make a top 10, Eastwood would be in there, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Brandon, which one of those do you hate less?
I prefer the Outlaw Josie Wales. I don't hate the Outlaw Josie Wales. It's just the politics. It's a bit much for me. And tonally, at times, it feels a little confused. But, I mean, it's okay when people are shooting each other. So, I'm not really going to give it.
Fortunately, that's a lot of the movie.
Yes, it is. I mean, I like that final shootout at the homestead. That's pretty exciting, you know, when they're, like, shooting people and they're falling down the hill. And stuff like that. Yeah. That's pretty exciting. But outside of the shooting stuff, not that attractive to me. But, I mean, it's okay. I mean, it's kind of the middle ground between recommended and not recommended. For me, at least. That's kind of it's in the twilight zone there.
Ooh.
Okay. Do you think that its status as one of the all-time classic Westerns is deserved?
That's a tough question because my taste is pretty bad. But I do think... Well, I think there are better Clint Eastwood Westerns out there, like the Man with No Name trilogy and High Plains Drifter and Unforgiven, that kind of thing. But I would not put it in my top 10, maybe even, probably not even top 20 or 30.
Is your top 10 just High Noon 10 times?
It's the original Magnificent Seven. We got High Noon, Duck, You Sucker, Man With No Name Films, Bad Day at Black Rock, maybe a few others.
Okay.
So some healthy amount of Sturgis and Leone.
Yeah, well, it's hard to argue with some of those. Those are excellent as well.
Yeah.
Just got to name drop the Wild Bunch here before we move on.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Well, you know, speaking of questionable taste, I'm one of those that I don't love the Wild Bunch.
Oh.
Same here. I like it, but I don't love it.
Yeah. Oh.
The characters are just too nasty.
I guess I think that the movie really, like the ending shootout is so good that it wipes everything out that came before it.
Yes.
And I think that that's the only thing that people will really remember it for.
Mm-hmm. It's like Ben-Hur in the chariot race.
Yeah. Well, it's exactly like that. Yeah. Where it's like the rest of this movie doesn't even matter anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's so good. You know, nobody done anything like that up to that point. So it's like, oh, it's just like a clear, like, demarcation. You're like, there's what movies before that shootout, and there's movies after. And that includes the itself. Yeah. The movie that came before doesn't even matter anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, The Wild Bunch is a good movie, but the characters, they're just thugs. I don't really care about them that much. I mean, when they get killed at the end, I'm kind of like, good. I don't care. But the action scenes are dead.
Happy ending.
Yeah, it's like, yes, they're dead. But, I mean, I love the action scenes in it. The action scenes are probably better than their imitators.
If Angel had lived, I would have liked this movie a lot more.
Angel was a good guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
But we can save that for the Wild Bunch podcast.
Yeah, but in this movie, I feel like it spreads out its action pretty consistently. Even like by the end of the movie, like you remember him shooting the soldiers outside the, was it a shop or was it a bar? But you remember that more than the fact that you're like, oh, he like opens the movie with like mowing down dozens of soldiers with a Gatling gun.
Because of the amazing one-liner.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Why, you're gonna pull those pistols or whistle Dixie?
The one-liners, like, punctuate the action. And they're not even, like, you know, everyone generally, I think people can, mostly because of the Bond movies, they kind of consider one-liners to be, like, the exclamation point at the end of an action scene. But this is a little more like Schwarzeneggerian, or whatever, you know, to fuck up coining a term.
Cone of phrase.
Which is, like, that it like precedes the action, right? And he does it both times that it's like really iconic, which is the Whistling Dixie line that I'm talking about here. And then there's the, you know, Dying Ain't Much of a Living. It's just like, oh, yeah. Shit, you know, it's his I'll be back. You know, he's like, I'm gonna say some shit right before. And Tarantino wishes he could do that. it's what Tarantino tries to do. And Eastwood does effortlessly.
But Tarantino tries to do it in 5 pages of dialogue and Eastwood does it in one line.
Yep. Well, I mean, famously, that's, you know, Sam Jackson in Pulp Fiction. What is his Ezekiel whatever thing that he quotes?
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, he's trying to build up to that. He's trying to do that, but Clint Eastwood does it in like a sentence.
Yeah.
Like half a sentence. He's like, oh, just say this thing. And people will be like, fuck.
I always remember this story of Harrison Ford on Air Force One, where the writer had written this entire monologue, and Harrison Ford just came in and said, yeah, I can do that with a look. So they cut out the whole monologue.
I'm going to say it in 4 words. Get off my plane.
And another great line, not from Clint Eastwood, but from John Vernon.
Don't piss down my back and tell me it's raining.
Yeah.
Great line.
Was that the famous line before like this film, or did it become like an iconic line after this? Because I've heard that before. People say that, like, don't piss down my leg and tell me it's raining. Wasn't that like a Judge
Judy I don't know. Well, I've heard it as well, but I have no idea if it came from this movie. It's one of those things. I'm just not old enough. Who knows?
Yeah, I'm not.
It's more of a saying than an actual like line, I think.
I still like it, though.
Yeah. He says that, and then he still goes along with the plan he's told to do.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Anything else?
No, I don't think so. Go see this violent fascist, humanist movie. And then watch Pink Cadillac, where Clint Eastwood plays Tommy Novak. No, I'm
not his best one, that one.
No.
No, yeah, check this one out. It's great.
I think we're like underselling it. It is like really good. I do think that it's worth its reputation as one of the best.
Yeah. And I do also sort of agree with Brandon that it does feel episodic at times, but I don't necessarily think that that's a bad thing in this case.
Yeah, well, it's not really a movie in three acts.
No.
There's like five or six, you know. So yeah, it's definitely got weird shit going on, but you know what? It's fucking awesome all the way through, I think.
Yeah.
Even when Sandra locks on screen.
It's watchable. That's my takeaway. It's watchable if you want to watch Clint Eastwood kill a bunch of people, but don't dig much further until it gets politics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brandon's over here like, don't piss on my back and tell me it's raining. I know fascist entertainment when I see it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, even the fascists, they can come up with some good entertainment once in a while. Not that I condone their beliefs.
No. But that's, you know, that's why George Lucas used Len Riefenstahl imagery.
Yes.
Every once in a while, they do some shit, and you're like, that looks cool.
Yeah.
We'll use it, and then not talk about genocide.
That's the way it goes.
Yeah. All right. Check out our very non-fascist website, allouthebubblegum.com. Join the Discord, check out the Patreon, and we'll see you next time.
All right, bye.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
When I was a kid, I liked Westerns a lot. I grew up watching Gary Cooper and Joel McRae and Randolph Scott.
What? Did we just become best friends?
Yep.